Hello, and welcome to the AK-47 podcast. My name is Kristen Godsey, and I am finally getting around to recording one of these. It's been almost a month since my last podcast episode, and I am back to read the fifth and final portion of Alexandra Kollontai's essay, The Workers' Opposition. But I thought I would pause for a second and just sort of give an update on why it's taken me a month to actually get myself to sit down in front of my computer with a microphone. So the semester started. That's always a big issue. It always feels like I am being launched out of a cannon as I get my classes prepared and various administrative tasks, since I am, in fact, the chair of my department at the University of Pennsylvania. And on top of that, as I'm sure many of you know, I have been on a book tour. So since the last time I recorded a podcast, I've been in Maine. I was in London for the How the Light Gets In festival. I was out in Grinnell, Iowa, giving the scholars convocation there. And next week, I will be in Brooklyn at the City University of New York and Brooklyn College, doing a talk with Liza Featherstone, who will be interviewing me about Everyday Utopia. And then that's Tuesday. And then on Wednesday night, I basically get on a plane and I am going to Brussels, Belgium, where I am giving a speech at the Festival of Liberty. And so it's been really a whirlwind. I have been doing a lot of talks, and I actually think when I get back from Brussels, I'm doing teaching a class at Princeton, and then I'm also doing an event at the Princeton Public Library in conjunction with Labyrinth Books on the 26th of October. So I've got a lot of events. And on top of all of that, I've been doing a fair amount of media. So I was on the Science podcast pretty recently, talking to the journalist Angela Saini. I was on the Atlas Obscura podcast, and that segment also ran as part of the Freakonomics podcast. A couple of wonderful reviews of the book appeared very late, but they did appear in Inside Higher Ed and in The Nation magazine. I will link to all of this stuff in the show notes if you're interested. I mean, you know, at this point, I feel like the book came out in May. It is now October, and it's kind of crazy that reviews are just now appearing and that I'm still being contacted by a variety of different podcast hosts and other people who want to talk about the book. I mean, I guess it's a good sign. The other thing that's been exciting is that the book launched in Germany on September 25th. And so now I'm doing a new round of media with a variety of different German media outlets and podcast hosts and newspapers and so on and so forth. So there was a long interview that appeared with me in Die Zeit online. I will also, if you are a German speaker, link to that in the show notes. So things have just been really busy, busy in a good way and busy in a kind of exhausting way. And so, as with so many things in life, you just never get around to those things that you really, really like doing or want to be doing. I feel like I've, you know, barely had time to do any yoga or time to, you know, enjoy the amazing weather that we've been having in Philadelphia. I'm sure so many of you have this same thing where things just get so hectic for one reason or the other, and then lots of fun things or things that you like to do just fall by the wayside. So finally today, I have an hour, actually, I have a half an hour now before my next interview. And so I am going to use this time to complete The Workers' Opposition, which I feel like I've now been reading all summer. And now that it is fall, we need to be done with it. So this is the very final section of this text, and it is called Objectives of the Opposition. And here, Kollontai is basically trying to diagnose what she sees as the problems with the Communist Party at that particular moment in time, and try to outline a role that the workers' opposition could play in helping the party kind of overcome some of the obstacles that it was facing. Here we go. The workers' opposition, the last part. Whatever the party leaders might do in order to drive away the workers' opposition, the latter will always remain that growing, healthy class force, which is destined to inject vitalizing energy into the rehabilitation of economic life, as well as into the Communist Party, which begins to fade and bend low to the ground. There are thus three causes which bring about a crisis in our party. There is, first of all, the overall objective conditions under which communism in Russia is being carried out. The civil war, economic backwardness of the country, its utter industrial collapse as an aftermath of the long years of war. The second cause is the heterogeneous composition of our population of 7 million workers, the peasantry, the middle class, and finally the former bourgeoisie, men of affairs in all professions who issuance the policy of the Soviet institutions and penetrate into the party. The third cause is the inactivity of the party in the field of immediate improvement of the workers' life, coupled with the inability and weakness of the corresponding Soviet institutions to take up and solve these problems. What then is it that the workers' opposition wants? What is its role? Its role consists in raising before the party all the perturbing questions, and in giving form to all that heretofore was causing only a subdued agitation in the masses, and led the nonpartisan workers even further from the party. It clearly and fearlessly shouted to the leaders, "Stop, look, and think. Where do you lead us? Are we not going off the right road? It will be very bad for the party to find itself without the foundation of the dictatorship. The party will be on its own, and so will the working class. In this lies the greatest danger to the revolution." The task of the party at its present crisis is fearlessly to face the mistakes and lend its ear to the healthy class call of the wide working masses. Through the creative powers of the rising class, in the form of industrial unions, we shall go forth toward reconstruction and the development of the creative forces of the country, towards purification of the party itself from elements foreign to it, towards correction of the activity of the party by means of going back to democracy, freedom of opinion, and criticism inside the party. Okay, that is the end of the workers' opposition. And clearly, we know from the history of the Soviet Union that the party did not return to democracy, freedom of opinion, and criticism inside the party. In fact, just a few years after Kollontai wrote this text, Stalin would come to power and would really rather severely clamp down on freedom of opinion and criticism within the party. And in fact, by the time we get to the late 1930s, there would be these massive purges, and many of the old Bolsheviks who stood by and fought with Lenin and Kollontai, they would all be dead. Kollontai manages to survive largely because she is irrelevant to the internal politics of the Soviet Union. By that point, she's completely sort of in exile in her ambassadorial position in Sweden. But here, as I have said in, you know, multiple other episodes, as we reflected on this piece, I do think it's interesting to note that Kollontai is really calling out the Communist Party of the Soviet Union here for abandoning what she calls the dictatorship. And what she means by that is the dictatorship of the proletariat. The fact that the state is supposed to represent the working classes. The state is supposed to represent these sort of industrial unions, these workers who have seized the means of production. Now, Kollontai is quite right, I think, to point out, and as many, many socialists and communists have pointed out, that Marx never imagined that socialism and communism would take root in a country as backward as Russia was in the early part of the 20th century. Communism, the idea of socialism, of seizing the means of production, of instantiating this dictatorship of the proletariat as a transitory state on our way to perfect communism when the law and the state would wither away, all of that was supposed to happen primarily in the advanced capitalist countries like Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. Russia was very backward, and obviously they faced massive challenges in the early part of the 20th century. Most notably, I think, as Kollontai points out, the war, the civil war, the famine, the collapse of their economy, the very diverse nature of the population. I mean, the Soviet Union had a relatively small working class. They had a much bigger and more opinionated peasantry that was not necessarily always on board with what the Bolsheviks wanted to do in terms of developing the economy in the way that they wanted to develop it, in this industrial way, modernizing the country, modernizing the economy. So there's this moment here, there's a sort of a critical moment where Kollontai and the workers' opposition are kind of calling out the party and saying, hey, you realize this revolution, you say you're Marxist, you say you're going to be doing these things, and everything that you're doing is kind of the opposite of what you said you were going to do and the opposite of what Marxist theory sort of suggests that we should be doing at this particular period of time. And probably most notably, which is not improving the working conditions of the working class. The lives of ordinary workers at this period of time in the Soviet Union was actually really difficult. And already you have the beginnings of an entrenched kind of red bourgeoisie, these new party elites that are sort of seizing for themselves all the rights and privileges of the former economic elites under the Tsar. So, you know, this is always going to be a criticism that anarchists have of any socialist or communist project that imagines that there is this intermediate state where the actual state, the government, kind of organizes the economy or organizes the affairs on behalf of the workers, this thing called the dictatorship of the proletariat. Most anarchists will say, look, that's just perpetuating the very institution that creates inequality and injustice in society. The state is actually part of the problem because the state exists to sort of protect and uphold laws and various sort of customs around private property, around the unequal distribution of rights and privileges. And so if you're going to rely on the state, if you're going to rely on a bureaucracy, if you're going to rely on a government to instantiate the workers' revolution, you've kind of already lost the plot. You need to go straight to some kind of totally democratic workers' control where workers actually have the ability to criticize and influence the shape that any sort of government takes. Now, there's lots to be debated here, and socialists and communists will say, yeah, but that'll never work. You can't devolve, you know, when you have this massive state, such a centralized authority like Tsarist Russia, you can't just go immediately to some kind of like decentralized syndicalist organizing structure. You have to have this intermediate stage. I mean, you know, there has to be this intermediate stage. Even Marx said so. And so it's a debate, obviously. It's still a debate. People are still arguing about these things. And I think it's really worthwhile to go back and read this essay by Kollontai and to really kind of dig in, as we have in the last couple of episodes, and say, you know, hey, a lot of the things that ultimately went wrong in the Soviet Union, a lot of the problems that they ultimately have, were diagnosed very clearly by Kollontai and the workers' opposition before they were silenced. Maybe the Soviet Union would have, you know, been a little bit more successful, more democratic. Maybe there wouldn't have been the Stalinist purges. There are all sorts of counterfactuals here if the workers' opposition hadn't been suppressed. So, of course, that's a counterfactual. It could be that the Soviet Union might not have existed. It might have been crushed. There might have been counter-revolutionary forces. Who knows what would have happened? They might not have been able to fight off Nazi Germany during World War II. I mean, there again, you know, when you play with these historical counterfactuals, it's always impossible to know. But for the purposes of just thinking about the future, thinking about how we organize oppositional movements, how we imagine a state or a non-state in the aftermath of some kind of global, you know, cataclysmic event that really challenges or undermines or just sort of obliterates capitalism in some way. How do we rebuild? How do we think about rebuilding outside of the framework of reform? I mean, assuming that we're thinking here about some kind of radical break with the past, do we go with the model of this sort of intermediate state where you have some kind of government or bureaucracy that is in charge of transitioning from capitalism to something that's not capitalism? Or is that just a recipe for disaster? Is that just a recipe for sort of perpetuating some kind of state capitalism, like you might argue they have in China? Or do you just immediately leap to some kind of radical, decentralized, syndicalist vision of workers' cooperatives and collectives that are sort of independently functioning and autonomous and self-sustainable, but somehow collaborative across, you know, wide geographic stretches so that we still have some kind of specialization and comparative advantage, but it's not necessarily centrally planned and it's much more kind of organic and self-correcting and fluid? You know, the practical part of me thinks that's just not going to work given the world that we live in, unless we want to go back to some kind of anarcho-primitivist world, which, you know, we could go back to for reasons not completely under our control if there's some kind of dramatic climate event. But in the absence of that, or in the absence of some event that really radically shakes up the way the world is currently structured, it's just really hard to kind of land on a strategy, a practical strategy for how to achieve sort of new and different kind of future. And this is where I get really bound up sometimes in, you know, debates in my own head where I feel like I have like a little anarchist angel on one shoulder and a little communist or socialist angel on the other shoulder. And they're arguing with each other about what is the best strategy forward. And in the end, I just sort of feel like it's really a difficult question. History is not necessarily a good guide for us, but there are lots of caveats and there are lots of things that we could learn from history. And so we should be thinking about the future creatively, and we should be thinking about the future with an eye to the lessons that we could learn from the past. So that's in some ways the whole reason why I'm doing this podcast. And I do think it's so important to remember that we don't have to reinvent the wheel as activists, but at the same time, we also really need to be creative because the circumstances of the early 21st century are so different from the circumstances of the early 20th. So on that note, I don't know if that's hopeful or if that's sort of depressing. I'm not really sure. I'm trying to be hopeful. I'm really trying to be hopeful these days. I feel like the whole point of Everyday Utopia is to get out there and get people to start thinking critically about utopian visions of the past and what we can learn from them in order to have new utopian visions for the future, because we really need those utopian visions. And I'm happy that the book is getting out there and finding an audience, and I'm doing everything I can to support it. But I also think it's really important for us to sometimes just stop and be like, okay, enough already. I just want to kick back and spend a few hours daydreaming and just imagining what some perfect world that might not ever come might be like. And maybe in those daydreams, maybe in that sort of reverie of social imagination, we can help each other find new and interesting and positive ways into the future. So anyway, thank you as always so much for listening, and keep up the good fight.